On this week's 51%, we hear from a journalist about the Highway of Tears and Indigenous communities in Canada.
Girls and women are vastly, vastly more likely to be murdered than anybody else in this country.
Plus, we remember one of India's most treasured writers. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Highway of Tears is a 450-mile stretch of Canada's Highway 16, which runs from Prince Rupert in the northwest corner of British Columbia to Prince George in the central interior. Since 1969, dozens of women and girls, mainly Indigenous, have gone missing or been murdered along this highway. In her debut book, Highway of Tears, A True Story of Racism, Indifference, and the Pursuit of Justice for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls, Jessica McDermid takes an in-depth look into the lives of some of the victims. 51%'s Elizabeth Hill tells us the 35-year-old investigative journalist says it was her time reporting on human rights in Africa that prepared her to tell this story.
Working in Africa, I learned a great deal about colonialism because, you know, you're living in, and working in these countries that are hugely impacted by their colonial history, and where there's huge inequality. And it was sort of a realization, I think, when I came back that I came from a country like that too. I had never seen it that way growing up. That's not the history you get taught in school, certainly. And it really wasn't something anybody in my sphere ever spoke about. But after being there and then coming back, and there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission underway in Canada at the time looking at the impacts of residential schools. And I just more and more was looking and learning and going, holy cow, Canada is a colonial country too.
Yeah.
And these issues that I've been sort of railing about in Africa are just as profound in my backyard where I grew up, which is, you know, the Highway of Tears. And it was a rude awakening, but it's so important because it is the truth.
I loved the foreword of your book. Can you explain who Mary Teege is and what it meant to have her introduce your book?
Yeah, so Mary is the executive director of Carrier Sicani Family Services, which is a First Nations-run organization that works in sort of holistic health for its members. And then Mary is also the cousin of Ramona Wilson, who is one of the girls who went missing in Smithers, the town where I grew up, and was found murdered about 10 months later. So I had talked to Mary over the course of my research and at the very beginning to sort of talk to her about my idea for the book, because she also is part of what's called the Highway of Tears Initiative, which has sort of a governing body that's done a lot of work trying to make the highway safer over the years. And she had mentioned the possibility about doing a foreword, but I was really, really nervous to ask her. And when she agreed, and then when she sent me what she had written, it was incredibly moving. I cried for a little while.
When did the investigation into these disappearances / murders begin, and what did it look like in its initial stages?
There had been investigations sort of on each case when it occurred. So in 1989, when Alberta went missing and then was found murdered in Prince Rupert, there was a police investigation into that. The following year, Delphine Nicole went missing from Smithers, and there was a police investigation into that. I think the sort of quality and depth of the investigations varied immensely, but it wasn't until the mid-2000s, 2006, that the RCMP, which is Canada's National Police Force, actually formed a task force to look at a number of these cases in a really sort of big, in-depth way.
Did you find, over the course of your investigative reporting, that there were similarities between the girls, women, other than their ethnic background that kind of made it more likely for them to be targets?
In some cases, yes. I mean, part of what the book does is go quite in depth into the stories of each of these girls and women and of their families. And there are similarities in many of the cases in their backgrounds. There's many of the girls and women are residential school survivors themselves, or their parents, their family members are. Residential schools were going on in Canada for many, many decades, where Indigenous children were taken away from their families and their communities and sent to these boarding schools with the idea of sort of taking the Indigenous person out of them and making them into, you know, white people, which just has caused an incredible, incredible amount of trauma. So that is a through line in many, many of these girls and women's stories. Many of them, you know, lacked transportation, safe transportation options. So when many of them went missing, some of them were hitchhiking. Lots of them weren't, but, you know, they were out walking, trying to get home, something like that. So they were vulnerable to predators in that sense. Some of them certainly also, they came from families that were struggling with the impacts of residential schools and other colonial measures. So, you know, issues that come from that sort of trauma, things like addiction, unstable sort of home lives, that kind of thing.
How and why have over 1,200 Indigenous women either gone missing or been found murdered across Canada? And what's being done at the national level to address this?
I mean, I think a lot of the why comes from the history of Canada and the colonization that happened, and a number of measures that were put in place by the colonial government that took away Indigenous people's land, took away their rights. For many years, Indigenous people were literally not defined as human beings under Canadian law. And residential schools. So, I mean, completely tore apart families, communities, cultures, languages, ways of life, and took away the land and the ability to live those sorts of lives, which, you know, has bled down into many, many, many struggles that now Indigenous communities face, one of which is that girls and women are vastly, vastly more likely to be murdered than anybody else in this country. And in terms of what's being done at the national level, there was a national inquiry held, which was something that families had fought for decades, to examine all of these cases and examine these causes and ultimately, you know, make recommendations to change it. Mm-hmm. So that completed in June of this year and included more than 200 what they called calls for justice, which are their recommendations, their calls to change the situation. Yeah. But since that came out, we just went through a federal election in Canada. And the previous election, 4 years ago, missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls really became an election issue. It finally sort of really broke into the national debate and consciousness, and people were really engaged, which led to the striking of this national inquiry. But since this report came out, you know, I hardly heard anything this time around in the election about it. It's been really, really quiet, and I worry that it's sort of fallen off the public radar again. And after so much work by families, first to get the inquiry and then to take part in it, which was, you know, a really harrowing and difficult thing for a lot of people, that it's just going to sort of become a report that sits on a shelf again.
As a journalist who grew up along Highway 16, you've touched on this a few times in the interview. You've witnessed this racism and injustice firsthand. What is the next step? You're worried about the issue kind of falling back. So how do we continue to work forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing and the thing that we can all do on an individual basis is just to learn and to care.
Yeah.
You know, and when we care, when the public cares, we've seen this with this issue, and we see it with all the other issues too. When the public cares, when we all you know, put some effort and some emotion into caring about each other, then it creates change. You know, the politicians respond to that. Police respond to that. All the powers that be respond. And so I think if we all, you know, educate ourselves, we learn the real history of our countries and what's happened, and we educate each other and we just care, that's the first step and probably the biggest one.
What do you hope your book brings about this story of Highway 16 possibly helping elsewhere in the world where women and minority populations are being treated similarly?
I guess there's a couple things. I mean, when I wrote it, I really put a lot of time and a lot of space on the pages into the people, the girls and the women who have gone missing and been murdered and their families, because I think it's been historically, even presently as well, way too easy for people to just kind of, you know, it's a number, it's maybe a photo, it's a statistic, and they forget or they don't even think about the fact that, you know, every single one of these people are real human beings. And I really wanted to convey that and sort of memorialize that in the hopes that it will make people care and make people be engaged and make them see that this is an issue that affects all of us. I mean, my interest in journalism was always sort of human rights and awareness and, you know, the horrible things happening to people in the world. The only way they'll be stopped is if people know about it. They won't necessarily be stopped then, but there's not even a chance if no one knows. Yeah. And so that was always my goal as a journalist, was, you know, to shine a light on it when people are being abused, when human rights are being abused. I mean, I guess the other thing is Highway 16, the Highway of Tears, is not really that remarkable. When you look at the numbers of unresolved missing and murdered cases in BC, when it comes to Indigenous women and girls, you know, it is a disproportionately high percentage in that area, but it's really not. There's a million highways of tears, I'm sure, in the world. You know, across Canada, we see this everywhere. I know there's areas in the States that face very similar things. Yes. And I think that the story and the hardship on the Highway of Tears, as well as the progress that's been made, you know, is something that people in all these regions can certainly learn from.
Do you think that social media and the social media platform has created more of a way to have this issue addressed? Like, if you, you know, back in the 1990s when Ramona went missing, she didn't have a cell phone, so it was calling the, you know, the place she worked, her family at home, and word of mouth, but not necessarily getting her face out to all of BC?
Absolutely. And that's something that came up, you know, in conversations with families of the girls and women who went missing earlier. Often was, if we had had Facebook, yeah, you know, if they had had a way to get the word out, maybe it would have made a difference, because they really, I mean, it was what they were able to do themselves, and it depended on the family and the resources that they had. And, you know, if you don't have a vehicle and you don't have a means to drive a couple hundred miles and the money to print a bunch of posters, and, you know, you're in an environment where you feel the police aren't doing much, the media is not covering it, you don't even have a way to tell anyone. Yeah. And at least now with social media, I mean, my Facebook is full of this, that missing cases. So it is a way to get the word out. And it also is a way to organize. And that definitely happened. Like, the first Highway of Tears walk in 2006, one of the ways that it sort of coalesced into a really enormous event was that people could reach each other on social media. And so, you know, you could post on Facebook that we're 20 kilometers from Terrace, and people in that community would come out and meet the walkers. And so it's also become quite a tool for organizing and talking about the bigger issues, as well as raising awareness of individual cases.
That was 51%'s Elizabeth Hill speaking with Jessica McDermott about her debut book, Highway of Tears, a true story of racism, indifference, and the pursuit of justice for missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. By the way, all the cases of missing murdered women in the book are still unresolved. The College of St. Rose, a private college in the capital city of New York, has opened its Women's Leadership Institute. 51%'s Jesse King reports from the new hub in Albany.
Walking through the new hub at the Michelle Cuzzo Brizenock Class of 80 house in Albany, you can see where the $1.2 million donation made by the building's namesake earlier this year was spent. The hub shines with brand new offices, gathering spaces, and a conference room. St. Rose President Carolyn Stefanko says the WLI is designed to support women leaders in the capital region and beyond. And Director Yolanda Caldwell says that starts with promoting discussion.
This is our living room space. And this is a space where our scholars, our students, our professionals will be able to come and sit and create theories, concepts, debate topics. Because we all know that learning comes sometimes from having an engaging conversation. And this space is set up just for that.
The 3,800-square-foot house is also home to the college's chapter of the Bold Women's Leadership Network, a national program providing financial aid, training, and internship support to women leaders. St. Rose became one of only six institutions across the country to join the program last winter. It has already selected its first two cohorts, 14 students total, and moved its seniors into the second floor, complete with a kitchen, in-house laundry, and colorful dorms. Junior Hannah Dietz won't move in until next year, but credits Bold with allowing her to live on campus.
Being a commuter student for the last 3 years, I haven't been able to have that intimate level with my friends because I had to balance going to college and then going home and then traveling every single day. On the bus, it took me about an hour and 5 minutes to get to St. Rose, but now with the scholarship, I'm able to have these connections. I get to have all these opportunities that I would have never had otherwise.
Caldwell says Bold scholars already participated in a leadership conference in San Francisco over the summer. Stefanko says the Institute is partnering with the Times Union's Women at Work Network to bring a 2017 poll on women nationwide in 2020. Created by Eve Walter, the View on Women looked at underlying attitudes toward women across New York State to better understand why issues like domestic violence and the gender pay gap persist. Stefanko says the WLI will present the 2020 poll when it hosts the International Leadership Association's Women in Leadership Conference in June.
We're going to learn a lot more about how we focus our energies at women's leadership institutes and women's programs in corporations and higher education to really do things that will make a difference. So it's going to be a very important part of it because we'll be collecting data that will actually translate into action. So I'm very excited about it.
All of this work and any upcoming programs is to be guided by a new 14-person advisory board with figures including News Channel 13 anchor Elaine Houston and former Albany Law School dean Penelope Andrews. Stefanko says the college intentionally sought out members with a range of experiences.
The Women's Leadership Institute is going to serve students at the College of St. Rose. It's going to serve people in the capital region of New York, but it really is intended to serve women across the country and around the world as well. And that's why the advisory board members who were invited to participate are from other countries, are from other parts of this country, as well as from the capital region.
The College of St. Rose marks its 100th anniversary in 2020. First founded as a women's college, St. Rose became fully coeducational in 1969 and now serves nearly 4,000 students. Women make up about 67% of its undergraduate population and 78% of its graduate students. For 51%, I'm Jesse King.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
At only age 14, Sarah Berger Stearns attended a women's suffrage conference in Cleveland. In 1858, at age 22, she rallied a group of women and converged on Ann Arbor to ask that women be allowed to attend classes at the University of Michigan. The administrators replied, "It seems inexpedient at present for the university to admit ladies." Undeterred, Stearns got her degree somewhere else and moved to Rochester, Minnesota, where she made a name for herself, giving lectures on women's issues. In 1875, she convinced the editor of the St. Paul Pioneer Press to support a Minnesota amendment that would allow women to vote for and serve on school boards. The amendment passed. In 1881, Sarah Berger Stearns became the first president of the Minnesota Women's Suffrage Association. They wanted to vote in all elections. Stearns never got to see that come true. She died in 1904, 15 years shy of the 19th Amendment which gave women the right to vote.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
Afghanistan's first female ambassador to the United Nations has started a UN group to protect the rights Afghan women gained after the Taliban was ousted from power 18 years ago, amid fresh efforts to rekindle talks with the fundamentalist group to end the country's long-running war. Adila Raz told reporters November 12th that she is not totally certain women's rights will be included in future talks with the Taliban, which is a key reason she spearheaded formation of the Group of Friends of Women in Afghanistan. The Taliban imposed a harsh form of Islamic law when they ruled Afghanistan in 1996 through 2001 that barred women from education and jobs and subjected them to stoning. Raz says about 20 countries with female ambassadors and deputy ambassadors have already joined the Group of Friends. Sandeep Roy remembers one of India's most beloved writers, Nabanita Dev Sen, who died November 7th.
It was the 1960s. A 26-year-old Indian woman had come to Berkeley to do her postdoctorate all the way from Kolkata. The campus was on fire those days, says Anirban Chatterjee, who runs the Berkeley South Asian Radical History Walking Tour.
And then, that December, she was part of the first active mass student civil disobedience of the 1960s, as she joined thousands of other Berkeley students taking over Sproul Hall, standing alongside people like Mario Savio and Joan Baez.
Her friends seemed to remember that last week when on a rainy morning in Kolkata, they stood on the street outside her home, bidding her goodbye. Nabanita Dev Sen was a writer, a poet, an academic, but most of all, she was a free spirit, always ready to speak up for a cause.
And she did all this knowing that she was risking her immigration status by engaging in civil disobedience as a foreign national.
This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. Rebellion came naturally to her. If it wasn't free speech, it was Bengali sweets like the Rosogulla. Her niece, writer Dipanjana Pal, remembers a famous family story about how her aunt tried to come into the U.S. with Indian sweets like the Rosogulla. Stopped by customs, she refused to abandon the sweets. She protested.
But these are delicacies, she protests. They'll just rot if they're kept in quarantine for 40 days like he's telling her to.
So she just plonked herself down and started eating them right there.
If this can't enter America with me, then it will enter America through me, she said, and declared her intention to eat every damn Rosogulla.
Rebellion was in her genes. Her mother was a child bride, married off at 13, widowed by 14. She ran away to get married again, this time to another poet. After he died, three generations of feisty women, Nabanita, her daughters, and her mother, lived in a house named Bhalobasha. Bhalobasha, that means love in Bengali. It could also mean a good home. In this case, it was both. Jhuma Boshak, once her student, now a therapist in Kolkata, agrees.
I think a whole lot of us, you know, have gone to her in various junctures in our lives with broken hearts, with desires. And she has been completely non-judgmental.
Nabanita Dev Sen would remember little things like her birthday. She would call and say, come over, I made paish, a dessert, for you.
And I was like completely stunned, taken aback, thrilled. Because, you know, you still have somebody who would make paish for you and wait.
But she wasn't just a mother hen to a brood of students, writers, young women looking for feminist role models. She was pushing the envelope, writing about LGBT issues and AIDS in the 90s when few did that in Bengali. Not surprising, says Malavika Banerjee, who runs the Tata Steel Kolkata Literary Meet, where she had been a speaker.
Nothing defined her more than her free-spiritedness, her ability to accept everything that came her way.
Not even illness could dampen that, says Chuma.
There would be times she would be quite unwell. I remember an occasion where she had the oxygen nostril, the pipes in her nostril, and she was writing.
Some 80 books, like looking at the Indian epic, the Ramayana, through the eyes of the women in it. Children's books, travelers' tales, poetry. That raspy, breathless, excited voice was unforgettable.
What was the monkey saying? Was he a mad monkey? Tetanus, hydrophobia. God alone knows what else.
She'd studied at Harvard, Berkeley, Indiana, taught at Oxford. She also happened to be the former wife of the 1998 Economics Nobel laureate Amartya Sen. But the measure of a good life is not just in books written, prizes won, even Nobels, but also in lives touched, Juma Boshak.
And I often wondered where she got so much of love from to pour out.
And humor. Her last column came out this month. You could almost see her rolling her eyes as she wrote about her cancer. Okay, it's cancer. So what? I'm 80 plus. People are behaving as if I'm some young child who hasn't led a full life. Are, I'm not even dead yet. Why so much grief already? Malavika Banerjee agrees.
No, Bunita Di, I can't say rest in peace. Whenever I think of you, you're alive and you're bringing a smile to my face.
Many writers are respected. Nobunita Debshen was beloved, something much rarer. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1584.